A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, welcome to Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Naz Modirzadeh.
And I'm Richard Atwood. Today we're going to talk about Lebanon. The country is almost 2 years into an economic crisis that the World Bank says could be one of the worst anywhere for more than 150 years. Lebanon is falling apart.
Tragedy is unfolding in Lebanon. Inflation has driven the country's currency to historical lows. The crash highlights a grave economic crisis that has left half the population living below the poverty.
From Lebanon, the capital, Beirut, has been hit by a massive explosion. Dozens of people are said to be injured, and there are some reports of people trapped.
Since late 2019, the Lebanese lira has lost more than 90% of its value, causing massive inflation. Many businesses have lost access to credit. Unemployment has skyrocketed. More than three quarters of Lebanese now live in poverty. The toll on the state has been heavy. Lebanese state institutions are floundering, with budgets gutted and employees underpaid. The security forces are stretched even thinner, policing unrest. The lack of progress in investigating an enormous blast in Beirut's port about a year ago, which killed more than 200 people and left much of the city devastated, has made people angrier still. Despite the scale of the crisis, Lebanese elites have generally played for time rather than enacting necessary reforms.
Lebanon looks like being on track towards forming a new government. This after the businessman and twice before Prime Minister Najib Mikati won enough votes in parliamentary consultations earlier today to be nominated as the Prime Minister-designate.
Hezbollah supporters cheer and chant as their leader Hassan Nasrallah takes matters into his own hands, announcing that an Iranian fuel tanker would sail towards Lebanon and warning Iran's foes not to intervene.
The Beirut explosion that Naz mentioned, involving more than 2,500 tonnes of ammonium nitrate that had been stored unsafely for years, that forced the government at the time to resign. After a year of political wrangling, a new government is finally in place. But it largely comprises the same old faces, the same political elite who bear much of the responsibility for the crisis in the first place. Today we're welcoming on Heiko Wimmen, who's director of Crisis Group's Lebanon, Syria and Iraq project. Heiko's usually based in Beirut. We're going to talk about the crisis itself. We're also going to talk about what it's done to the country's politics and society. And we're going to talk about how Hezbollah, the political party and militant group designated by the US and Europe as a terrorist organization, we're going to look at how Hezbollah has fared. Heiko, welcome on.
Hi, Richard. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So, Heiko, why don't we start by asking you to say a word or two about what the economic crisis actually entails. I mean, what has it involved?
Well, you already mentioned the collapse of the currency, right? And that, of course, means that people have lost their income. It means people have lost their livelihood. It means that for businesses, importing and exporting has become a major challenge because not only has the currency collapsed, but the banks are insolvent. So the companies have their operational capital trapped, as you have said, but they also cannot transfer money easily between Lebanon and other countries. So that means you can't import raw material easily, which means you can't produce. It really affects all part of society. It affects all institutions because the liquidity crisis has by now caused a severe energy shortage. You have electricity cuts that are 22 hours per day, right? So having electricity is the exception, not the rule. You have general outage that's interrupted by a bit of electricity. And under these conditions, of course, the economy can only get worse, and we have a really downward spiral that sees big parts of society fall into poverty.
And Heiko, what does this look like for Lebanese families?
So, I mean, imagine, for instance, you have an elderly parent or relative, right, who needs medical care, you know, or any person who needs medical care, and you will struggle to find the medication because medication is simply not available. Much of it in the pharmacies, you won't find cancer medication. A friend of mine, her aunt, just recently, her cancer that was in remission apparently came back, and they're scrambling to get the medication for a new round of chemo, which is simply not there. So that's one part of it. I mean, that there was a moment when the American University Hospital, which is one of the finest medical institutions in the country, said, okay, if we don't get diesel within 48 hours, all patients in the intensive, in the ICU ward will die, right? Because the machines will stop.
And you can also hear stories of you know, not just obviously fuel prices being hiked and there being massive queues outside gas stations, but also simply people being unable to afford food in the way that they used to, simply because of inflation, that the money they have simply doesn't add up to buying basic groceries anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we keep seeing these figures, inflation on basic food items within 1 year, 400%, I think was the latest for August, maybe, that I remember. And it's as simple as that. The 750,000 lira was the minimum wage in 2019, and it still is, you know, and everybody who earns in lira, works for the public sector, still has that kind of income. It hasn't given them a few extras here and there, but it amounts to nothing, you know. And meanwhile, like, everything has become 10 times more expensive. It's as simple as that. So by now, the minimum wage that you have, these 750,000 liras, they fill up a car once. You know, that's what a minimum wage does. It fill up a car once, 750,000. They give you, if you have, like, to have very basic electricity, pay for a generator that you have maybe 10 hours electricity on a very low level per day, you pay twice the minimum wage, you know. So how are you going to pay for food? So in the end, it really goes down to the very basic, you know, people. Like, the army already a year ago cut meat from the diet of its soldiers. You know, so that tells you how far to the bottom, to the basic it really is.
And Heiko, how has the COVID-19 pandemic played into this?
Well, COVID-19 obviously had made things much worse. It has meant that several times the country went into lockdown. Businesses that were already hit were hit more. That has pushed unemployment. And we've seen in the beginning of this year massive riots in the north, in Tripoli, because of COVID shutdown measures that put people who are like daily workers, who really live hand to mouth, literally, who depend on earning a daily pay and couldn't find it anymore because everything was locked down. These people were rioting. And you got an idea how quickly things could really go over the edge.
So, Heiko, just so our listeners understand, could you sort of explain what actually caused the economic crisis?
Yeah. So to break it down very roughly and to a simple explanation, Lebanon has, for the past 30 years, consumed massively more than it produced. And that means, of course, imports, and imports far outstripping exports. That means you have dollars flowing out of the country and you don't have enough dollars flowing into the country, right? And at some point you will have a dollar scarcity and this has to stop because people simply don't have any dollars left to pay for the imported goods, and Lebanese lira are not accepted outside the country as a convertible currency. Now, what the Lebanese did over these 30 years, to some extent, they relied on remittances from the diaspora. I mean, that's fine. You know, you can do that potentially forever, as long as the diaspora sends this money. And the other part of the gap, and that was a significant part of it, they attracted foreign money. They attracted foreign direct investment in the form, to a large extent, in the form of bank deposits. And then the Lebanese Central Bank would use that money, essentially, to fund this consumption, to plug that gaping hole between what the country produced and what it actually consumes. You know, and that went on for quite a while. And then some of these foreign funds dried up to some extent because the diaspora wouldn't send back as much money as they used to. And to the other extent, because international rating agencies started highlighting that this was not sustainable. So Lebanon started to slide in these evaluations. And then the central bank went and started taking money from the Lebanese. So Lebanese traditionally had a lot of their savings in dollars. They had historical experience that, that if you have dollars, you're fine. If you have liras, you may wake up and they're gone. So people had dollars and they put those dollars in the banks. And the central bank started hoovering up these dollars, basically telling the commercial banks, give us your dollars. We pay you a wonderful high interest, you know, and they tell that to foreigners too. And it kept going on and going on. And the interest had to get higher and higher. And you were essentially paying the old creditor with the money of the new creditor. So it was a Ponzi scheme, essentially. It was a Ponzi scheme where you had to bring in new fresh dollars all the time and to keep the music going. And at some point, it was just the music stopped. The credibility was gone. And then people started going to the banks and said, oh, I want my dollars, but the dollars are not there.
Heiko, can I ask you, for those who may have followed the story of other currency failures or even massive economic crises like the one in Greece, what about this is different? What makes it so extreme?
So you could say, for instance, Greece in the end had the euro and the EU and the European Central Bank to save it somehow, right? You could say that Venezuela, of course, is in the pits, but Venezuela at least has oil. So in the end, they still have something to sell that brings in some money. And these are just two examples. Lebanon, they simply don't have any of these things that they could fall back on. There's nobody to bail them out. There are no resources that can be sold off to generate cash to keep things somehow afloat. And they're really just utterly bankrupt. I saw some estimates that say the banking crisis alone may cost between 25 billion and 125 billion. That's a Standard & Poor's study. And the scope, I mean, the margin between the lower and the upper estimate already tells you it's so enormous that you don't even know how much there really is. You know, how deep you don't, the hole is so deep you don't even see the ground.
And Heiko, so we have this report that you worked on that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks that looks at the sort of political and social implications of this terrible economic crisis. And in it, you talk about the increasing insecurity. Can you say a word or two about sort of what that looks like?
So some of it is actually too clear to see, and you can spot it. And you see it in security incidents. When the fuel crisis was especially bad, we had almost daily news about fights breaking out with people like from this village wanting to fill gas and that in the other village, and the other village wouldn't let them. So this is our benzene, go fill where you are, and all of this, you know. And then people would guns would come out, you know, and then in some peripheral areas there was fighting over firewood. You know, people are gathering firewood for the winter because they know they will not be able to afford heating oil anymore. So then two villages started fighting over logging rights in an area, and they come out with medium-sized weapons like rocket-propelled grenades and stuff like that. So this is dramatic, and you see it. What is less visible is the general deterioration of security. A young woman that my colleague interviewed told him like how she goes to the streets and she sees this young man sitting around and taking care of security, right? And watching security in the area because there have been theft, you know. Theft has been going up. Nobody does anything about it. It becomes more bold. And then she told me, look, as a young woman, you know, I need somebody to keep the streets safe. These guys are doing it. And she didn't like that. She didn't like this idea. But this is how, let's say, people who don't take their personal security necessarily for granted, for whatever reason, gender in this case, how these people experience that. I think they are the best barometer for it. And you see that everywhere. If you look closer, you see it everywhere, and you hear it from people who know people in the security services. If there's calls, there's something going on, there's some violence here or there. In many cases, the police wouldn't go anymore. You know? I mean, why would they? They're getting paid $50 a month. You know, who would put himself in harm's way for $50? You know, I mean, you can have security forces go that way for maybe a month or two or three, but now it has been going on. They have been in this situation for more than a year, and at some point, they reach breaking point. And I think many are probably past the breaking point already.
So we describe in the report how much the economic crisis has eaten into Lebanese institutions, partly because there's no money in the budget, partly because civil servants, whether they're teachers, people working in hospitals or people in the security forces, the real value of their salary has gone down so much, as you say. But how in particular has the economic crisis and this increased insecurity, how has that impacted the Lebanese security forces?
So the security forces have been doing more and more with less and less. And we've already said that their salaries have collapsed along with everybody else's. And of course, nobody can survive that way. So what they do, what the army apparently is doing, according to reports, it's a bit difficult because this is very sensitive. Whatever you say about the army it often causes reactions. So reporting about it is very muted. But from what I heard is that the army is actually organizing in many cases, or maybe superiors are just organizing schedules in a way that soldiers can have a second job, right? So soldiers are moonlighting essentially, and the army is facilitating it or looking the other way. It is technically illegal. But the alternative is that these people are going to desert. So you now have soldiers that are actually working a part-time job. At the same time, the army has taken on more and more responsibilities and has more and more replaced the state in areas where it's really has no business of doing that, or where it shouldn't do that, you know, simply because it's somebody else's job, or they're just can't do all these things at the same time. They have led the response to the port explosion. That has the army, the disaster response. The army has almost completely did that. They have played a huge role in the COVID response to basically enforce the lockdowns and everything. I mean, they're sent everywhere where there are riots or problems. Now with the fuel crisis, the army would go around gas stations to prevent people, or rather traders, from hoarding benzene, you know, and as a result, last month there was an incident where something like I think a dozen soldiers died in an explosion of fuel that they had found hoarded in some place, and then handled in an unsafe way, exploded. These soldiers died in the most gruesome ways you can imagine, you know. So basically, the army is worn down that way. And sooner or later, the army will also reach breaking point. And that then means that, like the police now, according from what people tell me, who know people in the police forces, the army may more and more simply not show up when it should or when it would be needed, you know, to, and people will have to organize their security locally themselves. So you have basically the state retreating from the responsible of maintaining security. And then once the army is no longer capable, then you will have other actors doing it, filling the void.
And Heiko, can you tell us a bit more about these other actors as both the army and the police and security forces are under the kind of strain that you're describing? Who is coming in to fill the void?
Now, mostly still informal forms of private security provision. You know, these guys that sit on the corner, right, and watch out what's happening at night in the neighborhood. At some point, they will have to be paid. At some point, they will have to be organized. And then, when that is the case, political parties, I think, at least some of them, will be best positioned to actually do that organizing. Because they have the organizational structure already, right? They have networks. And some of them do have residual, you may call it militia capacity. And then other parties, and of course Hezbollah is the one that we all have in mind, have actually a fully fledged army at their disposal. Hezbollah has its own police forces, for instance. So they'll be able with what they can do to control their areas pretty firmly and keep them safe, I believe. And I think the situation will also be okay in areas that are affluent, you know, where people can afford to have a private security force that acts more or less professionally, that are maybe soldiers or policemen who are moonlighting, right? But there are other areas where you have neither the money nor the political structures to do this, you know, and that's where things are problematic. There's a place like Tripoli in the north where you will have these rackets, or you already have them, and then you'll see that these rackets come to blows, you know, who controls which neighborhood, who taxes which neighborhood.
So, Heiko, Lebanon is still sort of haunted by a 15-year civil war that ended in 1990, and it was a war that was fought along sectarian lines. So the insecurity and the violence you're describing, is that playing out mostly along sectarian lines? I mean, is that worsening Lebanon sectarian relations, or is it more complicated than that?
So it's certainly worsening the relations, the sectarian relations or community relations, and in particular since there is a certain part of the Lebanese population that is explicitly blaming Hezbollah for the crisis, right? And they basically say, you know, that it's all because of them, you know, it's because of them that we are a pariah state. It's because of them that our economy collapsed. It's because of them that nobody can or want to do business anymore. And I would say that is inaccurate. The financial crisis was not caused by Hezbollah. But it is a sentiment that many people have, and that poisons, of course, relations between the communities. Because, of course, the supporters of Hezbollah respond in kind. You know, they have their... They throw the blame back at the US, who are like supposedly besieging Lebanon, and then they accuse their opponents of being collaborators. So that's on the level of the political debate. Now, on the grassroots level, if you want, so if you have shortage of resources, then you have, of course, resource competition, right? And that shortage, or these competitions then quickly can become violent competitions sometimes along sectarian lines, you know. And we've seen that last month when there was an incident of Christian Village, where the gas stations refused to sell gas to people from a Muslim village down the road. And then, as a result, there was an attack from the Muslim village on the Christian village, you know, and it's not, the attack was not smashing the gas station. I mean, they smashed other things too, but they also smashed shrines, right? They smashed shrines, they walked through the town and shouting sectarian slogans, you know, and you very, they shut down the road to that village. So with the villages and Christian villages sitting in the middle of a Shia area. And then these little incidents very quickly tap back into a memory of sectarian conflict. And it awakens like fears that are dormant or latent when they're can very easily be summoned. So that has happened more than once, and it could easily become worse. You know? In particular, since sectarian identities are identified with these political positions. And so these like altercations become very, very quickly charged, highly charged, and then you have a potential for things spinning out of control very quickly.
And Heiko, Lebanon hosts, what, 1.5 million Syrian refugees? I mean, something like that. I mean, how have the shortages affected relations between Lebanese and those refugees?
So the figure that I prefer to use is closer to 1 million, but never mind. I mean, it's a huge number. And so, I mean, you quoted figures earlier about how many Lebanese live in poverty. The UNHCR, I think, puts that figure for the Syrian refugees, or maybe for refugees in general, I think at 98%. They're all destitute. They receive some very basic support, humanitarian support, really, to survive, on a survival level. And that already creates tensions with the Lebanese, who believe that the refugees are being helped while they themselves are starving. And relations have gotten worse. It's quite clear. So there have been incidents of riots, attacks, of like some incident leading to a whole Syrian refugee community being run out of a town. One guy did something that was related to a personal dispute, you know, and then 1,000 people were made homeless, essentially, and violence happened in the process. So this happens increasingly. There's competition in the lowest bracket of the labor market. So the Syrians, of course, work in agriculture and building mostly. And those are parts of the labor market that Lebanese in the past would usually not work in because the pay was too low and it's also a social status question. Now they're increasingly pressured to do so, but then they go and find Syrians who have these jobs, you know, and work for so extremely low salaries, you know, that it's basically for the Lebanese to compete on salaries is almost impossible. So aggression builds up there, and there is definitely more tension.
Heiko, we talked a bit earlier about the port explosion and its role in the buildup to the crisis. Can you tell us what's happening with the investigation?
So an investigation has been going on, of course, for a while already. And we now already have the second investigative judge. The first one was removed because he wanted to summon politicians that are close to the power elite. Now the second has been trying the same, and it's actually quite impressive. The Lebanese judiciary is not generally known as the most independent, but you have every now and then you have these very courageous judges that simply have high personal integrity. And Judge Bitar seems to be one of those. And he has been summoning people who clearly don't want to be summoned and who don't want to be held accountable. And they've been trying all kinds of procedural tricks or maneuvers through parliament and other ways to avoid questioning. And there have been attempts to remove Judge Bitar as well from his post, which so far have been unsuccessful. I mean, he has reportedly been threatened, even by Hezbollah, to tone down, essentially. And it seems he's not intimidated. So concerning the actual investigation,
From what I understand, of course, we don't know everything that Judge Bitar has been doing exactly in details. I mean, but the impression is that what the investigation will find is proof of gross and perhaps criminal negligence and incompetence. And that is something that clearly some people want to avoid.
So, Heiko, we've talked a little bit about Hezbollah already. Obviously, Hezbollah, very close ties to Iran and to the Syrian government. But could you say a word or two about the sort of international politics of Lebanon more broadly and how the economic crisis has played into that? I mean, other parts of the Lebanese political elite have close ties to the Gulf monarchies. Others have closer ties to the West. How has that evolved over this crisis?
So essentially, I would say this crisis has emerged and evolved without too much of a role for these external players, right? So the crisis itself is mostly homemade. The Western external actors have tired of the Lebanese elite and its inability or unwillingness to reform, and of the fact that whatever money you pump into Lebanon just dissipates without too much effect. So that's the one side of it. I mean, they're still offering that aid or that assistance, but the Lebanese have to deliver now before they get the money, and it doesn't look like they can. So that's one part of it. And now concerning the other side, I mean, Iran, of course, has not too much to offer in terms of economic support, unlike the US or Europe or the Gulf, indeed, could. But Hezbollah has pursued this narrative or reiterated this narrative throughout the crisis, that this is a US siege and this is economic warfare and all of that. And it has become more vocal about that. And it has proposed an alternative for Lebanon to turn east, to cooperate closer with Syria, Iraq, Iran, China. And now with the Hezbollah now, at this point, when the energy crisis has become really crippling, has started to import oil from Iran on its own account, in flaunting U.S. sanctions. And the message, it's mostly about the political message, of course, is there is an alternative. I don't think that this is necessarily a credible alternative, but it makes an impression in those parts of the population that do support Hezbollah already, and it helps them to basically avoid being blamed for the crisis in their own constituency. Not completely, but it helps in buffering against attacks and criticism that says, "Well, you were involved in all this mess. You have been in the government as well. What did you do? You know, why did you let it come to that?" The Gulf countries finally, apparently, have mostly given up on Lebanon. So nothing is coming from there either. There's one political party that still receives money from the Gulf and a few players here and there. But largely, Saudi Arabia, which is what is calling the shots in the Gulf, does not want to go near the Lebanese file anymore. There may be personal issues involved between Mohammed bin Salman and Hariri in particular. But in general, I think it's also fair to think that as long as Hezbollah has this strong position within the Lebanese power system, the Gulf will simply not put in a single dinar or dirham or whatever currency they have.
So we have a new government in place. What are their immediate priorities for reform? And if I can just add to that question and ask, in all the discussions of Lebanon, there's this sense of, you know, there must be reform, calling for reform. Can you also say a bit, what does reform mean in a context where the situation is so dire?
Let's start with a new government. So an important thing to note about the new government is that they only have 6 to 7 months at best, right? So elections are due in May. There's been talk to bring them forward even to March. And so that would mean 6 months and not more. So what can you do in 6 months? I mean, you know, negotiations with the IMF are typically time consuming, and other, I mean, legislation in Lebanon has never been fast. You know? So what can you do? And the prime minister, the new prime minister, actually, 10 days ago, roughly, sat down in a 1 hour interview on Lebanese TV, television, and was quite clear about what he is trying to do, and which is basically he wants to chart a way to reform, and by negotiating with the IMF, and apparently they have formed a new negotiating team. Yesterday was the news that negotiations have actually started. They really want to press ahead with negotiating with the IMF, or rather reopening negotiations, because there have been negotiations already, and which failed a year and a half ago, roughly. So he wants to revisit and revise financial rescue plan that the previous government has worked out, and then was torpedoed by people with economic interest and political clout who felt that their interests may suffer. So he wants to revisit that plan. And I think these are the biggest pillars of his strategy. And apart from addressing the very immediate crisis symptoms, some of them, not addressing them, alleviating them, you know, like getting a bit more gas to the gas stations, getting a bit more electricity, again, by using money that he actually doesn't really have, or that is desperately needed for any reform strategies. So he's trying to plug some of those most damaging holes, or fix them, at least put some stopgaps in there, while negotiating the exit plan or the rescue plan with the IMF. And then, when come election, he hopes to have this plan ready, so that the next government could then implement. And of course, that implies that the electorate, the Lebanese electorate, has a say. So people can then vote, and this new government would have the legitimacy to implement whatever reforms. So that's the plan that he has. I'm a bit skeptical of if he can succeed.
So Heiko, what is your sense of the prospects for change right now? What are the prospects for reform in light of the story you've shared?
So I'm unfortunately I'm not very optimistic. The challenges to these plans are enormous. One thing is they need to revive the financial sector, right? You cannot have an economy without banks. You cannot have an economy without credit, right? And which all of now is not there. So they need to revive that sector. And that means you have to allocate these colossal losses that are in the system. I mean, you have to do something about these zombie banks, you know, who pretend that they have assets that don't exist. And that is going to affect the shareholders of the banks. And it may have to mean that they're losing their banks. That's why the financial rescue plan was sabotaged last year, because simply bank owners in Lebanon are closely linked with the political elite, and they were able to exert enough pressure to shoot this down. The second point is you need to clean up the central bank of Lebanon. Until today, it's unclear how much money there even is in the central bank. It's unclear if the gold that the central bank supposedly possesses is actually there. You know, the gold is $15 billion. Last time that this gold was counted was in 1996, right? So nobody knows if it's there. The political elite, since the beginning of the crisis, has stalled and delayed on the audit of the central bank. Why is that so? Well, the suspicion is, of course, that they have something to hide, and auditing the central bank would pull skeletons out of closets that would compromise members of the political elite. And the third big obstacle is in Lebanon, you have an enormously big public sector. It's like 350,000 people. It's one-fourth of the active labor force. It will not be possible to come up with any plan that brings the state back to financial, fiscal sustainability without shrinking the public sector. And you have to shrink it massively. And these 350,000 people, they're all voters. And with relatives and dependents, they're much more than that. You know, so any politician who touches this file, it's a suicide mission. And so the bottom line of all of this is, even the very basic steps to come to an IMF agreement that may then open doors for more money. It's extremely unlikely that the political elite will do this because it essentially undermines their own interest. It destroys the banks that many of them owns. It may ruin their political careers. It will destroy their voter base. Somebody in an international organization said that to me in so many words. For the political elite, adopting significant reforms would be political suicide.
So, Heiko, traditionally there's been this sort of argument in Lebanon that people were so scarred by this horrible war 30 years ago now that they will do everything possible to avoid anything similar in the future. But does that still hold? I mean, how long before things boil over, whether it's sort of people on the streets or struggles between some of the factions that you described?
So that's a very good and difficult question. One thing is, of course, that the civil war ended in 1990, right? So that's 30 years. There's a whole generation of people, of almost two generations by now, that have no memory, no active memory of the war. So that's one thing. The prospect of things taking this turn again is another thing. I mean, a civil war, of course, needs, at least two parties that fight it out, right? And right now we don't have that. We have one party that has the capacity to wage war, and that is Hezbollah. We have other parties, political forces that may have some military capacity, but there's no realistic chance that these will confront Hezbollah at any point in the near future. Now, what we can have is gradual deterioration of state control. And you have the country falling apart into a mosaic of areas that are controlled by these or that factions, you know. And then some of those may come to blows occasionally.
Heiko, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And I hope I didn't present a too gloomy picture for the audience.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Naz Modirzadeh.
And I'm Richard Atwood. You can find all of our work on our website, crisisgroup.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, @crisisgroup.
Thank you very much to our producer, Sam Mednick.
And thank you, as ever, to all our listeners. If you like the show, please do leave us a positive review or a rating. If you have questions, comments, don't hesitate to get in touch. And we hope you'll join us again next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.